a hefty revenue, and the middle class boycotted imported luxuries such as cigarettes, whose sales halved. In the northwest frontier province, a charismatic pacifist named Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan inspired non-violent protests, including a refusal to pay taxes. More than 200 of his followers were shot dead, but Hindu soldiers in a regiment from the Himalayan foothills refused to open fire on these unarmed Pakhtun farmers. On January 25, 1931, Viceroy Irwin released Gandhi from prison, where he had been for 8.5 months, and subsequently summoned him for discussions. In return for certain concessions, such as the right of villagers living near the coast to make salt, the liberation of non-violent political prisoners, and a promise to invite the Congress for talks, Gandhi called off the movement. In London, Winston Churchill charged the Viceroy with craven capitulation. "It is alarming and also nauseating to see Mr. Gandhi, a seditious Middle Temple lawyer, now posing as a fakir of a type well known in the East, striding half-naked up the steps of the Viceregal Palace, while he is still organizing and conducting a defiant campaign of civil disobedience to parley on equal terms with the representative of the King Emperor," he told a Conservative association in February 1931. As the chief spokesman for the Indian Empire Society, an association devoted to the preservation of the British Raj, Churchill would write and speak extensively on the topic over the next few years. The crux of his argument was that granting any power to a tiny oligarchy of Hindu politicians, the leaders of the Congress, would be a dereliction of duty to ordinary Indians. In his view, native politicians were incapable of rising above the confines of the communities to which they had been born. It took the distant Briton, who stood far above the fray, to adjudicate impartially among India's quarrelling castes. For the British Raj to abandon its responsibilities would be an act of cowardice, desertion and dishonour, Churchill argued, as well as a hideous act of self-mutilation astounding to every nation in the world. His furious efforts bore fruit. Gandhi, arriving in London in September 1931 to attend the promised conference, found himself facing princes, landlords, merchants, and representatives of various religious and ethnic groups from his homeland, all of whose concerns would have to be met before His Majesty's government could be confident that Indian self-government would not degenerate into a Hindu dictatorship. Virtually every representative demanded a separate electorate for his constituency, a privilege already enjoyed by Muslim politicians. That is, every minority Indian would be forced to vote for someone of the same religious or ethnic persuasion. Gandhi refused. The entrenchment of such divisions was anathema to the secular Congress. Chief concrete result of the human Mahatma's visit is that in London the price of goats and goat's milk has gone up, quipped Time magazine, after noting a goat whose milk Gandhi drank and who had been labelled Mahatma at an agricultural show. By the time Gandhi returned empty-handed to India and called for a renewal of civil disobedience, Lord Irwin had been replaced by a new viceroy, Lord Willingdon, who took a harder line. Gandhi was rearrested on January 4, 1932, and within 4 months around 80,000 protesters would be jailed. As if to underline their power, the authorities increased the tax on salt, which during fiscal year 1932 yielded a record revenue of 102 million rupees. The government of India had finally begun to act sensibly, Churchill noted with satisfaction. "I always said how easy it would be to crush Gandhi and the Congress." Dara had been released from prison, thanks to Gandhi's understanding with Irwin. He began to hide out with other Congress agitators in the countryside. They were well protected by the conch shells possessed by many Hindu women in nearby villages. The women blew the shells during their evening puja or prayer, sending a long, melodious call resonating through the dusk. But when one of them spotted policemen passing by, she would blow the shell then, prompting mothers, wives, and daughters for miles around to relay a cacophonous warning. Except in the dead of night, the police had no hope of catching anyone by surprise. In 1932, in a fresh act of resistance to the Raj, Midnapore's householders started refusing to pay a small tax that maintained the village chowkidar or watchman, who often doubled as a police informer. In response, parties of police, usually Muslims from northwestern India in largely Hindu Midnapore, divide and rule being the principle by which keepers of the law were assigned to different regions, established camps alongside the villages. In lieu of the tax of a few rupees, they confiscated cattle and jewellery worth thousands. The government also imposed a punitive tax to fund these police outposts. Villagers unfamiliar with English called it the pituni, or beating, tax because of how it was extracted. Also in these years, the Great Depression overcame rural India. High grain prices in the 1920s had allowed some cultivators to accumulate savings in the form of gold or land, which had prompted an increase in taxes. Although the prices of wheat and rice began to slide in 1930, slashing farmers' incomes, cultivators still owed taxes and other dues. Moneylenders, who through a chain of refinancing arrangements were ultimately beholden to banks, ran out of cash, refused additional credit, and instead forced peasants to pay up their debts, which they did by confiscating the gold, bangles, earrings, and necklaces belonging to the family's women. The alternative was to sell land, which for a peasant was the last resort because it deprived the family of its cheapest source of food. The Secretary of State for India and the Governor of the Bank of England controlled the colony's monetary policy. They ensured that as much as possible of this distress gold flowed to the United Kingdom. In the United States, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt stopped the export of the metal and used the country's gold reserves to support the value of the currency, allowing him to inject money into the economy to revive it. Historian Dietmar Rothermund has written that had the British government in India been more responsive to the needs of the people, it similarly would have collected the distress gold and used it to finance projects to alleviate rural suffering. Instead, banks melted down 3.4 billion rupees, 255 million pounds worth of gold jewellery, into bars and shipped it to London, helping to buttress its threatened position as a financial capital of the world. As a result, rural India was drained of its savings, leaving peasants defenceless against future economic shocks. By the end of 1932, the civil disobedience movement was petering out. Also that year, the government of India announced a so-called communal award. Along with reserved seats in Parliament, every significant minority group would have a separate electorate. Gandhi, who was in prison, embarked on a fast until the leader of the depressed classes agreed to merge his constituency with the general Hindu electorate in exchange for a larger number of reserved seats. When in 1935 His Majesty's government enacted into law the colony's new constitution, Nehru charged that it petrified British rule in India by playing off different constituencies against one another. The Act strengthened the alliance between the British government and the princes, landlords, and other reactionary elements in India. It added to the separate electorates, thus increasing the separatist tendencies. It consolidated the predominant position of British trade, industry, banking, and shipping, and retained in British hands complete control over Indian finance, military, and foreign affairs, Nehru would write in A History of India. The new political arrangement gave elected ministers certain responsibilities, such as in agriculture and education, but posed no bar that would keep India from being inducted with or without its acquiescence into World War II. After having served 6 months for his satyagraha against the war effort, Sushil Kumar Dara emerged from prison in the spring of 1941 to find that the leader of his local Congress cell, a dedicated Gandhian named Kumar Chandra Jana, was still in prison. Jana's wife was running the cell, and around this motherly figure had gathered a cluster of young women who were eager to join the fight. Most of these recruits had very little schooling, and it became Dara's pleasurable task to teach them poetry, the history of rebellions around the world, and the political ideas of Gandhi, Nehru, and Bose. Dara became entranced with one of the women. Kumudini Dakwa was dark-skinned, sweet-faced, and quick-witted, with almond eyes that held an inexplicable allure. It was just as well that a few years earlier, when his mother had pressed him to get married, Dara had sworn to remain celibate until the land became free. Kumudini was the wife of his close friend, Kudiram Dakwa, with whom he had played pranks on unsuspecting elders when both had been in school and later in the same prison. She found Dara attractive as well. His deep voice had a magical ability to entice, Kumudini Dakwa would recall decades later, and his impassioned recital of the poem Bidrohi, Rebel, made revolutionaries of us all. Soon the women were touring the countryside, exhorting everyone to help the movement in any way they could. With Dara around, none of us felt any fear at all, Dakwa remembered. His high spirits, his patriotic songs and poetry recitals, and his attention to the trainees' every need made it fun to become a Swadinata Sangrami, or fighter for freedom. As they trekked around the villages, urging the people to refuse help to the government, Dara and his fellow rebels often found shelter in the homes of ordinary villagers. "We were very young, would run around a lot," Dakwa related. "Once we were all sleeping on the upper floor of a mud hut, and we were so many and so rowdy that the roof fell. We were terribly embarrassed. The lady of the house came up and said, 'That's okay, the old roof fell, so we'll build a new roof. Why should you be upset?' The villagers loved us so much. They'd keep piling food on our plates, even when we were stuffed." During 1941, as Churchill crossed the Atlantic Ocean to seek help for the war from the United States, Amory dispatched Indian troops to secure the oil fields of Iraq and Iran. Bose strove to gain German assistance for Indian liberation. Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, unknowingly sealing his own fate. Nehru languished in prison, and Gandhi fretted about the scarcities stalking the land. A suppressed but powerful surge of excitement was mounting in rural Bengal. No matter what their imperial rulers believed, slowly the people were realizing that the era of the British was coming to an end, Dara wrote. At the same time, war-related shortages of food, cloth, and kerosene, used for lighting lanterns — rural Bengal had no electricity — were making survival ever more difficult. In every villager's heart, a small flame of rage was spontaneously coming alive. "We began to fan the flames," Dara recalled, "in the hope of uniting them all into one gigantic conflagration." Chapter 2. Harvesting the Colonies. "Shoot Gandhi, and if that doesn't suffice to reduce them to submission, shoot a dozen leading members of Congress, and if that doesn't suffice, shoot 200, and so on until order is established." Adolf Hitler had advised the Viscount of Halifax, formerly Lord Irwin, Viceroy of India, when they met in November 1937. "You will see how quickly they will collapse as soon as you make it clear that you mean business." Hitler esteemed Britons and Germans as superior races that nature had designed for hegemony over lesser peoples. Divining the British Raj to be the source of English pride and affluence, he sought to bestow a similar empire on his compatriots. As he saw it, Britons could continue ruling over Indians while Germans would subjugate Slavs. The labour of the vanquished races and the natural resources of their former territories would nourish and enrich the victors. Hitler's determination to carve the Third Reich out of the countries on Germany's eastern border would place him on a collision course with the United Kingdom, even as the conviction of shared destiny would complicate his attitude toward the British, the adversaries he could not but admire and undermine his prosecution of the war. Perhaps because of his racist world view, Hitler did not comprehend the extent to which the Indian freedom movement, along with other developments of the 20th century, had weakened imperial controls over the colony. The days of formal empires were numbered, and, ironically, the conflict he initiated would deal the fatal blow. To commandeer Indian manufactures and produce for the war, His Majesty's government would have to deploy inflationary monetary policies in preference to straightforward confiscation of the colony's products or revenues, which would have met with resistance from the colony's business elites and politicians. In the short run, the United Kingdom's wartime financial arrangements with India would set the stage for famine, and in the long run, they would hasten the disintegration of the British Empire. Hitler had been influenced in his thinking about Indians by the eugenicist Houston Stuart Chamberlain, whom he dubbed the Prophet of the Third Reich. Chamberlain admired India's caste system as having been engineered to preserve the purity of Aryans, but he nonetheless considered modern Indians to be a bastard people hopelessly contaminated by inferior blood. During the 19th century, tomes from ancient India had been translated into European languages, revealing a prehistory of colonization of that subcontinent by whites. Around 2000 BC, Caucasian nomads on horseback, who called themselves Arya, had poured into the Indian plain through passes in the northwestern Himalayas. They had settled on the banks of western rivers, adopted agriculture, and founded a civilization. Their earliest text, the Rig Veda, spoke of battles against the aboriginal Dasyu, or dastards. The Aryan god of storms, with his bolt of lightning, flays the enemy of his dark skin, kills him, and reduces him to ashes. The Rig Veda proclaimed of the dastards. Many of the Dasyu were expert farmers and city builders, but in defeat they became the Dasa, or slave. They were inducted into the lowest ranks of a severely hierarchical and patriarchal social structure called caste, over which reigned priests, Brahmins, and warriors. Western eyes could still discern the Aryan stock in the northwest of India, where the men were tall and light-skinned. But as the invaders had penetrated the subcontinent, bedding native women, their pure warrior blood had succumbed to dilution, according to Herbert Risley, a late 19th-century anthropologist. Every successive tribe of conquerors became more or less absorbed in the indigenous population. Their physique degenerated, their individuality vanished, their energy was sapped, and dominion passed from their hands into those of more vigorous successors. In the distant east, where the influence of Aboriginal women had been strongest, the ancient miscegenation had resulted in the feminized Bengalis, whom no necessity would induce to fight, another British scholar commented. According to Hitler, if anyone had asked Lord Robert Clive by what right he had seized the riches of Bengal, he would have replied, "I am an Englishman." Racial superiority entitled the British to the possession of India, Hitler informed a student body in Munich. Accordingly, the Führer considered the anti-colonial movement, a rebellion of the lower Indian race against the superior English-Nordic race, to be as futile as it was contemptible. The Nordic race has a right to rule the world, and we must take this racial right as the guiding star of our foreign policy, he said in 1930. Hitler had only a secondary interest in regaining the German colonies in Africa that had been confiscated by the Allies after World War I. What he wanted most of all was to conquer an extended backyard that could be defended by a land-based army. Germans would thus realize their inherent eminence and restore their prosperity by acquiring Lebensraum, or room to live, toward the east. In two books, the second of which was published long after his death, in pre-war speeches and in wartime after-dinner monologues, Hitler laid out a blueprint for the economic regeneration of Germany that drew on the British Empire as a prototype. White men, he stated in a 1932 address that won him the support of leading German industrialists, had exercised their extraordinarily brutal right to dominate others, which they possessed by virtue of their race, in order to reorganize the economy of lesser peoples in India and in the Americas, thereby procuring their own prosperity. The English, in particular, had achieved a wonderful marriage of economic conquest with political domination that had given rise to a remarkable development. Instead of expanding in space, instead of exporting men, they have exported goods and have built up an economic world system. Thanks to such a process, white nations had come to possess gigantic world central factories, for which the rest of the world provides enormous markets for the disposal of goods and enormous sources of raw materials. This state of affairs, Hitler maintained, could persist only so long as the difference in the standard of living in different parts of the world continues to exist. The imperial lifestyle required lesser races to be preserved in poverty. Different countries had safeguarded their economic superiority in different ways, he continued. Most brilliantly of all, perhaps, England, who has always opened up for herself new markets and immediately anchored them through political dominance. Germans, having been in Hitler's view idealistic rather than pragmatic in their approach to colonies, had failed to make adequate use of them and thus had been unable to guarantee an adequate standard of living for the fatherland's domestic industrial workers, laying themselves open to the spectre of communism. The Führer would repair German fortunes by creating sources of cheap food and raw materials, as well as expansive export markets. This would necessitate acquiring fresh territories. The Ukraine would supply the ruling race with bread, the Black Sea with an inexhaustible supply of fish, the Crimea with oranges, cotton, and rubber, and the crowning glory, Russia, would be an insatiable captive market for German cotton goods, household utensils, all the articles of current consumption. The Slavic areas would also provide fields for Germans rendered superfluous by industrialization, an aspect of Hitler's dream that was inspired not by India but by the colonization of North America by white farmers. Such expropriations of the colony's resources and products would result in the deaths of tens of millions of Slavs by famine and disease, estimated a Nazi policy paper formulated in 1941. Because Germans would deploy, divide, and rule to retain control, only a few selected officers would be needed to administer the vast new territory. The Russian space is our India, Hitler elaborated. Like the English, we shall rule this empire with a handful of men. His favourite movie, the 1935 Hollywood production Lives of a Bengal Lancer, depicted the adventures of a few such valiants, English cavalry officers at India's northwest frontier. The movie illustrated the feats that the warriors of an inspired race could perform in service of their homeland, and Hitler made it compulsory viewing for SS guardsmen. A great deal about Hitler remains mysterious, but his daydreams of world conquest were transparently inspired by what might be called empire envy. Envy is one of the less pleasing features of the German character, and there is a peculiar German word, Brotneid, envy of another for earning the bread that might be yours, which conveys tersely what Germans felt about our wealth and the vast resources of our empire, wrote Leopold S. Amery in his autobiography. Looking back on the costly struggles and sacrifices of their own history, they felt that our empire had been far too cheaply won, largely won, indeed, by utilizing Germany as a pawn in our long struggle with France. Not only cheaply won, but cheaply held, not by the kind of sacrifice which conscription imposed upon Germany's manhood to maintain her frontiers, but by a navy. In 1934, Amery had read Mein Kampf and found it very interesting and stimulating, as he wrote in his diary. Hitler's intense sincerity and clear thinking on some points, as well as really careful study of propaganda methods, attracted me very much. On the other hand, the author was clearly quite insane about Jews and socialists, Amory observed. The next year, when he was holidaying in the Bavarian Alps, Hitler had invited him for a meeting. The Führer looked unprepossessing, rather like a salesman in a gent's clothing store. Amory did not find the hypnotic charm I had heard of, and no attempt to exercise it, but liked his directness and eagerness to let his hearer know his mind. Amory judged that Hitler had a grip on economic essentials and on many political ones, too, even if it is crude at times and coloured by deep personal prejudice. Like Hitler, Amory believed that less developed parts of the world, such as India, should provide raw materials and markets for the highly industrialized centres of imperial power. Amory did not regard Indians themselves as greatly inferior, however. His confidence in their abilities underlay his later attempts as Secretary of State for India to secure the assistance of native politicians and manufacturers in provisioning the war effort. In part because of personal experience, he was aware that political disadvantage did not necessarily indicate feebleness in character or intellect. Historian William D. Rubinstein has discovered that Amory's mother came from a distinguished Jewish family, many of whose members had converted to Christianity. Amory himself had a deep-seated empathy for Jews and was one of the architects of modern Israel. But he kept his origins a close secret throughout his life and dropped not a hint of his Jewish ancestry in three portly volumes of autobiography, which he could not complete. Given this background, Amory's rather positive appraisal of Hitler is astonishing. Like many others, he may have assumed that Hitler could not possibly carry out the exterminations that he had hinted at in Mein Kampf, nor could Amory have foreseen a bizarre personal tragedy. His troubled elder son, John, would turn into an anti-Semite and, finding himself in Europe in 1942, would travel to Berlin to assist Hitler with his war effort. Leopold S. Amory was born in northern India in 1873 to an English forester and a woman of East European extraction. When Leo was three, he went to England with his mother and younger brother, and in their absence his father abandoned the family and moved to Canada. Leo's mother was forced to live in boarding houses while she spent all her money educating her sons. Nobody could ever give herself over so helplessly to laughter, and laughter was a large ingredient in our childhood's atmosphere, Amory remembered. Leo was precocious and spoke Hindi fluently when he left India. From his father's side, he inherited a diminutive frame, he was 5'4", and from his mother's, a gift for languages, of which he would learn 15. He read parts of the Mahabharata in Sanskrit and once astonished a London audience by reciting the first book of the Quran in classical Arabic. At Harrow, the brilliant youngster garnered most of the prizes, and encountered a bumptious redhead by the name of Winston Churchill. During Winston's first summer at Harrow, he spent hours by the swimming pond eating buns and sneaking up behind unsuspecting boys to push them in. One day he saw a student standing right on the edge of the pond and gave him a shove. I was startled to see a furious face emerge from the foam, and a being evidently of enormous strength making its way by fierce strokes to the shore, Churchill recounted. He ran, but his pursuer easily caught him and flung him into the pond. It was Leopold Amory of the sixth form. He is head of his house, he is champion at gym, he has got his football colours. Mortified, Winston approached the potentate the next day and explained, I mistook you for a fourth form boy, you are so small. Since Leopold did not seem at all calmed, Winston brilliantly improvised, My father, who is a great man, is also small. Leo laughed and indicated the end of the episode. Neither ever forgot this introduction, however. Amory went on to Oxford University and eventually became a fellow of All Souls College in whose lounges not only scholars but also cabinet ministers, bishops, members of parliament, civil servants, lawyers, journalists, and businessmen conversed on equal terms. It was the intellectual soul of the empire, and Amory one of its brightest lights. He served on several fronts of World War I as an intelligence officer, went on to hold important positions in the British government, and drafted the Balfour Declaration of 1917 that promised Jews a home in Palestine. By 1938, Amory understood the ferocity of Hitler's ambitions and joined Churchill in attacking the British government's policy of appeasement. Listening to a broadcast of one of the Führer's speeches, he found it terrifying. "It was the most horrible thing I have ever heard, more like the snarling of a wild animal than the utterance of a human being." In April 1941, a week after his arrival in Berlin, Subhas Chandra Bose submitted to the German Foreign Ministry a couple of detailed memoranda on how the goals of Indians could mesh with those of the Axis. In Mein Kampf, Hitler had described India's nationalists as a coalition of cripples and asserted that he could not link the destiny of my people with that of such an inferior race. His contempt for the Indian independence movement indicated a reversal of German policy, which during World War I had been strongly supportive of Indian insurgents. In 1915, German agents acting in concert with Sikh emigres in Canada and the United States had sent a shipload of arms to Bengal's revolutionaries. The plot was foiled by the British. Aware of Hitler's attitude, Bose anticipated resistance from the German government. He nevertheless hoped that rational self-interest would prompt the Nazis to take him seriously. "It is one of the cardinal principles of British diplomacy to adopt a sanctimonious role when she is fighting, in reality, for her own selfish interests," Bose wrote in his proposal. His Majesty's government had, for instance, allowed several European nations to set up governments in exile and thereby acquired credentials as a champion of freedom. Why should not the Axis powers adopt the same policy and pay England back in her own coin? Germany should shelter a free Indian government and, through broadcasting incendiary messages, sending weapons and other supplies to revolutionaries and other means, incite the subcontinent to rebellion. Moreover, he asserted, if the Axis powers publicly committed to liberating British colonies, they would prompt defections among Indian soldiers fighting in the Middle East and Africa, and once the loyalty of the Indian army was shaken, the arrival of a small force of 50,000 men with modern equipment on the colony's border would be enough to topple the British Raj. Whereas Bose was exaggerating the chances of success of such a rebellion, historian Milan Hauner has argued that the Nazis could have significantly disrupted the British war effort by providing prompt and substantial assistance to anti-colonials in India, Iraq, and elsewhere. It was not to be. The German government granted Bose a beautiful house in Berlin and permitted him to violate the Reich's race laws by living with and later marrying an Austrian woman with whom he had fallen passionately in love while exiled from India in the mid-1930s. Reuniting with her was no doubt a motive for his desperate escape. The Nazis also permitted Bose to recruit thousands of Indian soldiers captured in northern Africa for a liberation army that he dreamed would march into its homeland via the Afghan border. But although the Italians and the Japanese urged a joint declaration in favour of Indian independence, Hitler refused to go along. He feared that any open threat to the Raj would strengthen the British resolve to fight on against the Germans. Despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, Hitler still fancied he could reach an accommodation with the United Kingdom. The previous summer, in July 1940, the Führer had announced to horrified generals his determination to eventually attack the Soviet Union. He nursed a fond hope that when Russia had been crushed and Britain stood alone, it would accept the position of Germany's junior partner in world domination. During the whole of my political activity, I have always expounded the idea of a close friendship and collaboration between Germany and England, Hitler had declared in April 1939. Surely, he said, the British could understand that just as the Raj gave meaning to their lives, the vision of a thousand-year Reich gave purpose to Germans. Hitler had made several peace offers to Britain, at one point putting forth an assurance to the British Empire of German assistance, regardless of where such assistance should be necessary. But the United Kingdom had rejected Hitler's overtures. Instead, it had sent troops to defend France, and in the summer of 1940 had dispatched bombers over Germany, some of which had dropped their payloads on residential areas. On September 4, 1940, Hitler announced that his patience had run out. He would force the United Kingdom into submission. Starting 3 days later, some 200 bombers at a time, escorted by hundreds of fighters, attacked London and other towns almost every night for 2 months straight. Churchill visited a shelter at Bristol in April 1941, where an old lady who had lost everything to the bombs saw him and cheered, waving the handkerchief with which she had been wiping her eyes. The Prime Minister choked up and remained sunk in thought on the train home. When he broke his reverie, it was to announce that he would ensure that Britons got all the nutrition necessary to protect them from the strain and stresses that they may be subjected to in this period of great emergency. Although a Grow More Food programme had boosted domestic production of wheat, potatoes and other staples, vast quantities of provisions would nevertheless have to be acquired abroad and transported to the British Isles. If the United Kingdom had an Achilles heel, it was the stomach. Two-thirds of the island nation's food was imported, which made its very sustenance vulnerable to disruptions in shipping. During World War I, German U-boats in the Atlantic had threatened the delivery of imported wheat and provoked panic hoarding, causing temporary shortages. After that war, civil servants had formalized plans for feeding Britain in wartime. In a crisis, the government immediately would have to demonstrate that it was on top of the situation, or else people would build personal stockpiles, depriving others. The cost of living, in particular the prices of bread and potatoes, should be tightly regulated so that no one went short of calories, and the more nutritious foods should be rationed to ensure adequate proteins and minerals. In 1936, a government committee had recommended that the United Kingdom build a stockpile of at least 3 months' usage of food and animal feed in order to guard against wartime disruptions of supply. By the time World War II broke out, the entire machinery for feeding the country was in place. To watch over the care and feeding of Britons, Winston Churchill recruited a trusted old friend, the physicist Frederick Alexander Lindemann. Known as the Prof to admirers because of his academic credentials and his brilliance, and as Baron Berlin to detractors, thanks to his German accent and aristocratic tastes, Lindemann was responsible for the government's scientific decisions. He also headed a statistics division, or S branch, with whose help he scrutinized the performance of the regular ministries and prioritized the logistical machinery of warfare. Lindemann attended meetings of the War Cabinet, accompanied the Prime Minister on conferences abroad, and sent him an average of one missive a day. He saw Churchill almost daily for the duration of the war and wielded more influence than any other civilian adviser. On most matters, Lindemann's and Churchill's opinions converged, and when they did not, the scientist worked ceaselessly to change his friend's mind. He spoke sotto voce, but with complete self-assurance, as though stating facts that must be obvious to every schoolboy, related Roy Harrod, an S-branch employee who later became one of Britain's premier economists. All those who disagreed with his views, Lindemann dismissed as perfect fools. To create the 10 lines of text for the Prime Minister's benefit that summarized weeks of S-branch research, he wielded the final scalpel, taking out redundant words, unnecessary sentences, inessential parts of the argument, and many qualifications. According to Donald MacDougall, Lindemann's right-hand man at the S branch. At first, this last type of shortening worried me, and my colleagues, quite a bit, MacDougall confessed in a memoir. Soon, however, the S branch staff realized that the prof was merely anticipating the Prime Minister's wishes. The normal machinery of government churned up certain proposals, which finally came to the Prime Minister. It was our duty to counter-brief him on what we knew to be the lines of his own thinking, wrote Harrod. In other words, the mission of the S branch was to provide rationales for whichever course the Prime Minister, as interpreted by the prof, wished to follow. Other department heads were at first furious that the prof had access to their figures and used these to criticize their performances and overrule their decisions, even as they were prohibited from seeing the S branch's calculations and so could not defend themselves. But soon they began to realize that, like it or not, the prof was the man whom Churchill trusted most, and that not all their refutations, aspersions, innuendos, or attempts at exposure would shift Churchill from his undeviating loyalty to the prof by one hair's breadth, wrote Harrod. So it was that the prof would pronounce judgment on the best use of shipping space, the profligacy of the army, the inadequacy of British supplies, the optimal size of the mustard gas stockpile, the necessity of bombing German houses, and, when the time came, the pointlessness of sending famine relief to Bengal. Theirs was an unlikely friendship. Churchill was a self-described beef-eater who relished multi-course meals washed down with whiskey, whereas Lindemann was a vegetarian, teetotaler and non-smoker who lived on salads, egg whites, olive oil, and a specific variety of cheese. Churchill cared, if fitfully, about the troubles of the poor, but Lindemann made no secret of his contempt for social and intellectual inferiors, and, according to an acquaintance, looked upon poverty as a fault. His accent tended to arouse suspicion in wartime Britain, yet the mutual loyalty of the two friends was total. Love me, love my dog, and if you don't love my dog, you damn well can't love me, muttered a furious Churchill in 1941, after a member of the House of Commons had raised questions about the prof's influence. Lindemann's father was a wealthy entrepreneur of German origin who lived in the United Kingdom. Frederick was sent to Germany for gymnasium, and at the University of Berlin he studied physics with a pioneer of thermodynamics. He eventually landed a professorship at Oxford, and when World War I broke out, joined an aircraft factory. He learned to fly, and by repeatedly putting an aircraft into a downward spiral while memorizing measurements such as airspeed, he formalized recommendations for bringing an aircraft out of a fatal spin. This feat of nerves and skill would save the lives of many pilots, and it endeared Lindemann to Churchill when they met in August 1921 at the residence of a duke. Lindemann boasted a count for an uncle and possessed a chauffeured Rolls-Royce, which eased his passage into the aristocratic circles he cherished. A joke at Oxford ran thus, "Why is Professor Lindemann like a Channel steamer?" Because he runs from pier to pier. The physicist impressed the highborn with ridiculous ease, such as when he suggested to a duchess that they sit diagonally on a couch because it would make an improvement of 41.42% in space. Churchill declared that the prof had a beautiful brain and came to seek his assistance with practically everything that needed research. Lindemann had been to India once. In 1929, he visited an Indian mountain resort to serve on a panel on forestry. He was repelled by blacks, but he took along his English valet and did not have to be touched by native hands. On the strength of this two-month tour, he would aid Churchill with the colony's affairs for the next two decades. In 1931, Churchill asked him to study the constitution the British government was devising for India, to show up its weak points, and to ferret out the background and funding of the Indian National Congress. Apart from a distaste of dark-skinned foreigners and working-class Britons, the latter being insufferably stupid, Lindemann had a horror of ugly faces. These set up a violent prejudice which only the most supreme intellectual merits could counterweigh. He also possessed an ingrained anti-Semitism, which his reverence for genius could similarly overcome. Nonetheless, Lindemann's links with the continent made him one of the first outsiders to comprehend the reality of life under Hitler, and in the 1930s he rescued a number of Jewish scientists from Nazi persecution by offering them positions at Oxford. And when Churchill began to warn about the terrific pace of German rearmament, it was the prof who analysed the figures that bolstered his arguments. By 1942, Lindemann had the title of Paymaster General and had also achieved a peerage. He was now known as Lord Cherwell. His reputation was such that lines of verse inspired by the Pirates of Penzance were passed around ministerial offices. "My secretariat scrutinizes memoranda topical, elucidating fallacies in detail microscopical. I plumb the depths of strategy, I analyze ballistics, reform the whole of industry or fabricate statistics. My acumen's infallible, my logic irrefutable, my slightest proposition axiomatic indisputable. And so in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a good paymaster general." Lord Cherwell repaid his friend's patronage by adopting his causes as his own, and nowhere was this synergy more evident than in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral. One of the Prime Minister's abiding concerns was that the British people should get enough meat. "Have you done justice to rabbit production?" he asked in one of numerous memos on the topic. Another time he inquired if a ship returning from the Middle East might swing by Argentina to pick up some beef. The prof did not touch flesh, but when it came to feeding Britain he became an extreme anti-vegetarian. No one fought harder to keep up the wartime ration of good red meat for the British people, attested MacDougall. Chocolates and candy were also close to Churchill's boyish heart, and the prof brought his persuasive powers to bear against their rationing. He waxed eloquent about the significance of tea to the overworked charwoman, so that when the Food Ministry eventually rationed tea, which came from India, it ensured that everyone could get her favourite blend. Lord Cherwell did not smoke, but he argued that tobacco rationing would impose undue hardship on those who did. Nor did he touch alcohol, except when dining with Churchill, who insisted. Yet the prof strove to ensure that the working class was kept in adequate supplies of beer, which he believed it downed in the prodigious quantities of 10 pints a night per man and 5 per woman. A pint is a little less than half a litre. Nutritionists at the Ministry of Food had nursed a quiet hope that the war would allow the government to improve the eating habits and opportunities of the populace. That dream came true. Milk became free for the poorest mothers and children. The ministry maintained large stocks of wheat and flour, which it released as required to keep down the price of bread. And in the spring of 1941, copious quantities of high-protein foods, such as cheese and egg powder, began to arrive from the United States under the Lend-Lease program, which allowed resources to be shared among friendly nations on easy terms. Despite the casualties of war, by 1942 such vital statistics as life expectancy were recording their best levels ever. There were two problems. First, meat arrived on refrigerated ships that could serve instead as troop carriers. Keeping Britain in an ample supply of meat meant that tens of thousands of troops could not reach the front. Wheat, sugar, and farm animal feed similarly competed with steel that could be turned into tanks and weaponry. To his astonishment, Harrod was repeatedly asked to figure out how resources might be shifted from soldiers to civilians. It may be noted that the great words with which Churchill called upon the nation, blood and toil and tears and sweat, did not include the word austerity, Harrod pointed out. He was against it. The Prime Minister derided suggestions for austerity as self-strafing proposals, while the prof referred to them as the death of a thousand cuts. Everyone in the S branch took for granted that victory would go to the nation in which civilian morale was the better sustained, according to Harrod, and putting tasty food on the table was half the battle won. The second issue was Britain's incipient pennilessness. The United Kingdom's industries having been redirected toward supplying the war, the nation had had to cut down on exports. So the considerable imports of food and industrial raw materials, as well as the war effort in the Middle East and North Africa, were being paid for with borrowed money. The debts would become due after the war, and unlike past economic crises, when India had bailed Britain out, this time the colony was becoming, after the United States, the primary creditor. India is piling up sterling credit so fast that, having bought back all her government and railway indebtedness, she may want to buy out every British interest in India, a colleague warned Amory in January 1942. Provisioning the war would enable India to pay off its debts to the United Kingdom, reducing its usefulness as a colony and enhancing its prospects for independence. While the war raged, however, the economic stress induced by such contributions would build inexorably to the point of precipitating famine. In April 1940, the United Kingdom had agreed to share the costs that India would incur for the war. The colony would pay for expenditures that could be construed as purely Indian liabilities by reason of their having been undertaken by India in her own interests, which would come to mean all costs incurred within its borders and to its east. The United Kingdom would pay for soldiers and supplies used elsewhere, except for the cost of one division which accrued to India. But as long as the war lasted, the government of India would pay the United Kingdom's share, which would be counted as sterling credits to be remitted from London after the war was over. The agreement secured the enthusiastic cooperation of native industrialists and contractors. In the meantime, however, the government of India needed cash to pay for its purchases. Taxes and bonds failed to raise enough, so the presses went to work and printed paper money. World War I had demonstrated that India, as a major source of war materials, was vulnerable to inflation. Cash supply had more than doubled, and flowing to war industries had induced a kind of internal export, from the villages where food was grown to the factory towns and cantonments where it was consumed, and led to severe scarcities in rural areas. During World War II, however, defence expenditure in India would balloon by 17 times, and the money supply by between 6 and 7 times. The Indian Army was hiring up to 50,000 soldiers each month. Most of the new recruits suffered from anemia, and even those hailing from the more prosperous northwest gained 5 to 10 pounds after 4 months of eating a standard army ration. The most highly trained and best equipped divisions were shipped westward. Under General Archibald Wavell, they led the way to early victories against Italian forces in Egypt and Eritrea, while under the direction of General Claude Auchinleck, Commander-in-Chief in India, they took control of oil fields in Iraq and Iran. The bulk of the grain these soldiers ate continued to derive from India. In 1941, Bengal had a poor harvest, and several districts witnessed hunger marches. The authorities dismissed these as having been organized by designing persons to create political unrest and strove to ensure that no rumors of shortages leaked out. A British soldier wrote in his diary about an army wife who was stationed with her husband in India. She had told friends in Ceylon that she was pregnant, but soon discovered that she was not. Hoping to forestall the gossip, she sent off a telegram, "No bun in the oven," and got a call from irate censors demanding to know why she was spreading alarm and despondency and that there was plenty of food in India. Through his newsletter, Harijan, Gandhi warned Indians on January 19, 1942, that scarcities would worsen as the war continued. "There are no imports from outside, either of foodstuff or cloth," he observed. He advised peasants to grow banana, beetroot, yam, and pumpkin, which can take the place of bread in time of need. And the finance member of the Viceroy's Executive Council, Sir Jeremy Raisman, informed the War Cabinet in August 1942 that inflationary financing had led to the possibility that Indians would lose all faith in the currency. If farmers chose to store their grain instead of selling it for the suspect cash, that might give rise to famines and riots. Famines were integral to India's colonial experience, having been several times more frequent during the Victorian era when tens of millions died of hunger than during the Mughal period that had preceded the British. Although often triggered by drought, the famines were so lethal because India was exporting grain, some 10 million tons annually by 1900. Since the earliest days of imperial rule, the colony had sent abroad goods of greater value than it had received in return. Only in the period 1856 to 1862, when investment for building railways entered India, did this flow reverse. By the end of the Victorian period, India's export constituted almost exclusively the products of its fields. General Robert Clive's victory in 1757 had drastically altered India's economic relationship with the United Kingdom. Very soon after Plassey, the Bengal plunder began to arrive in London, and the effect appears to have been instantaneous, for all authorities agree that the Industrial Revolution, the event which has divided the 19th century from all antecedent time, began with the year 1760, wrote 19th century American historian Brooks Adams. The tribute from India, which amounted to almost a third of Britain's national savings for the last three decades of the 18th century, financed trading networks, serving as lubricant for the new economic engine. It also enabled suddenly wealthy merchants to wrest power from the monarchy and stabilize the British parliamentary system, which would thereafter provide consistent support for their ventures. Ironically, the lack of liberty in the colonies subsidized the increasing political freedom in the United Kingdom. Its head start in industrialization meant that for nearly 50 years Great Britain stood without a competitor, Adams continued. During this period, British banks, loaded with colonial spoils, lent to and traded with North America, Europe, and Australia, thereby helping them industrialize. These continents imported British machines and erected tariff barriers behind which they nurtured their infant industries. The pace of advancement in the United States and Germany ultimately left the United Kingdom behind, but Indian revenues would allow the imperial nation to retain its financial primacy well into the 20th century. Under English domination, India became a key foundation of the emerging worldwide capitalist edifice, wrote historian Eric Wolfe. India is your great free market, Lord Randolph Churchill reminded Parliament in 1887. Every kind of British goods flows into India without the smallest obstacle, and the possession of India is of incalculable value on that account to the British working man. During the preceding century, however, while its own economy industrialized, the United Kingdom had sheltered it from Indian imports, especially textiles. The new spinning machines were initially banned in the colony, and by around 1800, Indian cotton and silk products were either banned in Britain or subject to import duties of 30-80%. Had not such prohibitory duties and decrees existed, the mills of Paisley and Manchester would have been stopped in their outset and could scarcely have been again set in motion, even by the power of steam, remarked historian Horace Hayman Wilson. Between 1790 and 1830, textile exports from Bengal fell by 95%, while those from the rest of India were reduced by 30%. Instead, bales of raw Indian cotton and silk came to feed Lancashire mills, which churned out cloth cheaper than many an Indian artisan could. Targeted tariffs ensured that not only would Indian textiles fail to sell in England, they would often be more expensive than English textiles sold in India. English cottons paid at most 3.5% duty upon import into India, whereas native products were subjected to internal duties of up to 17.5%. As a result, Calcutta, which had sent to London £2 million worth of cotton goods in 1813, instead imported the same value of similar British goods in 1830. Dhaka, whose translucent muslin had once evoked awe, became ghostly as its specialised craftsmen deserted or died of starvation. Around 1848, spinning machinery was allowed into India, but tariff barriers continued to hinder the rise of a domestic industry until the 1870s, when a few mills came up near Bombay. By the mid-19th century, half of the United Kingdom's exports came from cotton manufacturers and virtually all of India's from its fields. The colony had been reduced from the state of a manufacturing to that of an agricultural country, as a director of the East India Company had predicted in 1823. In many villages of India, spinning wheels, which women had operated between bouts of housework, and weaving looms, which men had worked in slack seasons, were stilled. Bereft of income from their cottage industries, villagers became ever more dependent on the crops of the fields. The paucity of manufactures also meant that agricultural exports had to bear almost the entire burden of India's permanent financial obligation to the United Kingdom. The most visible portion of this payment, the home charge, met the expenses of overseas wars in which the Indian Army fought. The interest on mutiny charges, railway investment and other debts, the pensions of British citizens who had been employed in the colony, and all expenses, including salaries and banquets, associated with the India House in London. The home charge, which Her Majesty's government regarded as fair payment for services rendered and capital employed, came to £20 million per year by the end of the Victorian era. Indian nationalists, such as Dadabhoy Nauroji, argued that because virtually all of India's foreign exchange earnings were used for paying the home charge and for remitting to the United Kingdom the earnings of British citizens stationed in India, those profits could not be invested in domestic agriculture and industry. Most Indians thus remained so poor that they could not compete with foreign consumers in buying grain, with the result that a significant portion of the crop ended up abroad. Nationalist historian Romesh Chunda Dutt calculated that to meet its foreign exchange requirements, India had to annually export rice, wheat, cotton, tea, jute, indigo, opium, and other produce of the land, equal in value to a year's cereal for 25 million people. Such was the turn of the screw. To pay their rent, interest, and other dues, cultivators had to surrender their harvest, part of which was exported, thereby earning foreign exchange to pay for the charges, remittances, and imports, such as silver, to maintain the flow of currency. The tax and interest demanded of the grower meant not only that his produce would be extracted and placed on the market, but also that after meeting his liabilities, he would have little money left with which to buy food for the family, which in turn boosted grain exports. The advent of railways in the late 1850s had made matters worse. The government of India guaranteed British financiers a 5% return on railway investment, compared with the 3% interest that banks offered. As a result, more than 25,000